You're listening to Elephant Talk here on CHLY FM 101.7. Our first guest, our only guest today, actually, on the phone.
His name is Eugene Oscapella. He's an Ottawa lawyer and the president of Oscapella and Associates Consulting Limited. Mr. Oscapella is a founding member of the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy and was a former chair and member of the Policy Committee of the Canadian Criminal Justice Association. He also belongs to the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and the Drug Policy Alliance in Washington. He lectures in criminology at the University of Ottawa and frequently lectures elsewhere on privacy and drug policy issues. He has several publications in Canada and abroad. So, welcome, Eugene.
Thank you, Julie.
And we've heard, first of all, we sort of got alerted to you because we heard about a story that had happened in Nelson. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Well, this was a story that was reported by the CBC National News a couple of days ago, or several days ago now, I guess, about an off-duty Vancouver City police officer who was driving. I think he was actually heading to Coquitlam or somewhere. He was going into the interior of BC in any event, and he was pulled over by a police officer, and the police officer came up to his car, and he spoke with a very strong Texan accent. It turns out that the guy was a Texas state trooper or Texas Ranger. I don't know what the exact police force was, but it was a Texas police force, and he was up working with the RCMP here. My understanding is that they were the Texas police were helping train the RCMP in how to identify suspicious people who might be suspected drug carriers and things like that. So they pulled this fellow over. They wanted to search his car, and he knew his rights. He was a police officer. He knew his rights. Didn't tell him he was a police officer. They let him go, and then about a minute later, another stop occurred, this time when it was an RCMP officer, again accompanied by another Texas police officer. And this time he did agree to let them search the car, even though they didn't have the right to. They searched the car. They left his 2-year-old son in the car crying. They wouldn't let him take the son out of the car. They wouldn't let him watch the search either. And the justification they used for stopping him the second time was they said he was high on marijuana.
And how did they know that?
Well, they didn't. This was just, as far as I can understand, it was just a simple ruse to go ahead and justify the stop.
Yeah.
And after they found nothing in his car and found out that he was a police officer, they let him go. So, you know, there are a couple of serious issues here, one being the use of these, you know, obviously what appears to have been a very dishonest ruse to justify stopping the guy in the first place.
Do you know how long has this been going on, Texas Rangers up here? They're training the RCMP, or we are training
them?
Well,
apparently we do something with them, too, and so we've got RCMP officers down in the States. So the irony of this is that the United States, which spends tens of billions of dollars every year on drug law enforcement, doesn't have a better track record than we do in Canada. I mean, law enforcement cannot stop the flow of drugs because the black market is too powerful. When you prohibit drugs, you know, prohibition, just like the prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s in the U.S., creates an enormously lucrative black market. So it makes the substance, which would otherwise not be very expensive, it makes it fantastically profitable to sell. So, you know, by prohibiting these drugs, we actually make them far more interesting to organized crime groups to produce. And all the policing in the world cannot prevent this. All the policing in the world. The United States, which I think, as we all know, is the most powerful nation on earth right now, doesn't succeed in stopping more than about 10% of the drugs coming into its country. And it's still a major producer of marijuana. It probably produces half of its own marijuana. Basically, law enforcement doesn't work. So why have we got American police officers up here purporting to show Canadian police officers how to do it, when in fact they don't do it, right? They can't. What they do doesn't work in the United States either. You know, it's like the blind leading the blind.
Do you have any answers to that?
Well, the simple answer is that we have to regulate drugs and treat them as a health issue rather than dealing with them through the criminal justice system.
Oh, sorry, I meant, do you know why they would be up here? I mean, do they really believe that they're going to be effective?
They have joint operations all the time. I mean, the police forces share expertise across borders, and so we go down to the States. Our police officers would go down there to conferences and learn things, I think that's just part of an ongoing process. And there are also operational agreements between Canada and the United States. For example, a number of years ago, and there are probably many, many of these agreements. I certainly don't know of many of them, but there almost certainly are many of them. Agreements that allow, say, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, from the U.S. to operate in Canada in conjunction with Canadian police. So, you know, one of the big issues is, even if these agreements are legal, I mean, even if our governments have entered into an agreement saying, yes, Texas police, you can come up here and function in conjunction with the Canadian RCMP in carrying out operational matters, is that what Canadians want? I mean, do Canadians want American police forces operating in that way in Canada?
Well, what seems to be interesting in that point is that this guy was a police officer himself and didn't seem to know, first of all, anything about this, that it was going on.
Well, he'd have no reason to, really, because, I mean, Vancouver City Police and RCMP are different agencies, and you know, most people aren't going to know that there's a memorandum of agreement between Canada and the United States about the use of Texas Rangers in British Columbia. I mean, that's not something that most people, even police officers, are going to know a heck of a lot about. That those sorts of agreements are carried on at a very high level in government. So the average police officer isn't going to know much about that unless he's directly involved in one of those operations.
Well, I think what's also interesting as well, though, is that he personally found it unacceptable, and he's actually, hasn't he taken measures after the fact?
Well, what he did is he sued the RCMP for unlawful detention, and they settled out of court, but it still didn't prevent the issue from getting public. What he said, I mean, what the Vancouver police officer said himself is that look, we have a different style of policing up here in Canada, and I think... And you know, if you look at the nature of American policing and the nature of Canadian policing, I think most of us, as Canadians, want to have the Canadian style of policing, which is generally not as confrontational, generally not as abusive as some of the policing in the United States. We don't want those strong-arm tactics that have become very much a part of the war on drugs in the United States. At least I don't believe that most Canadians want that.
And those tactics don't seem to work, as you were saying.
Well, they don't work. I mean, if our drug laws could be made to work, the United States would have made them work, because it's the most powerful nation on earth. It has spent hundreds of billions of dollars in recent years, over the past two decades, trying to fight the war on drugs. And the United States is awash with drugs. Prohibition does not work. It cannot work. It is simply too profitable. But you know, people have to understand the basic economics of prohibition. When you prohibit something that people want, you prohibit cannabis, you prohibit cocaine, something that people want, who's going to go in and sell it then? If legal sellers aren't going to do it, criminals are going to move in to sell the stuff.
Yeah, because there is certainly a demand for it.
Yeah, and there is a demand for it. And so what have we done? Essentially, by prohibiting these drugs, we turn the trade over to the hands of criminals. And you're probably seeing more and more of that in BC with the... I mean, by criminals, I mean people who are sort of career criminals. You know, there are a lot of ma-and-pa operations and, you know, marijuana grow operations in British Columbia, and those aren't particularly a threat to society. I mean, they're just people. They are basically people who are seeing an economic opportunity and saying, "Look, I can make $50,000 tax free by selling pot." You know that whether you like that or not, those people are not a general threat to their community. The real threat to community is when those people get pushed out of the way and the trade goes into the hands of organized crime, because those people are violent, and that's the real dilemma. That it's one of the ironies of law enforcement. If you do manage to step up law enforcement to make it more intensive, you'll scare some of the small producers out of the market.
But you won't scare the big ones.
You won't scare the big ones. So essentially, tougher law enforcement acts basically it plays into the hands of organized crime, because it drives the small producers out and concentrates the trade into the hands of the larger criminal organizations. By stepping up policing on our drug laws, we are actually serving the interest of organized crime. And of course, if you step up policing enough and create a shortage of the drug, then the price of the drug goes up on the black market, and organized crime still makes an enormous amount of money from it. Prohibition doesn't work. That's, I mean,
It sounds like it works for the organized crime.
Well, yeah, well, prohibition, if you look at prohibition as something to benefit certain groups in society, it certainly works. Prohibition makes billions of dollars for organized crime. Prohibition, drug prohibition is one of the leading sources of the drug trade under a system of prohibition is one of the leading sources of income for some terrorist groups around the world. We're pumping billions of dollars into the hands of terrorist groups around the world simply because we're so foolish that as to prohibit these drugs rather than treating them as a health issue. And I want to make it quite clear to your listeners, I do not encourage the use of any of these drugs. Okay, I'm not here to advocate using drugs. I drink alcohol myself. I use caffeine. And those are both drugs. Those are both drugs.
So this has been going on for years, this so-called war on drugs. And whereas in Canada, we don't fight quite as hard and in the same way as they do in the States in this war, but we still do have a lot of the same tactics and ideas.
Oh, absolutely.
We cast this stuff as a criminal activity. And then, we see it in this small town of Nanaimo all the time, which is a port town.
Yeah.
We see people, like stories in the paper saying drug use is out of control, which it is, and drug use of things like heroin and crack cocaine are on the increase here.
Well,
and then they say we need more policing, and then they show next week, look at this, we've caught some drug growers, but they don't tell you that who they've caught is a small grow operation that has nothing to do with the heroin and cocaine.
And first of all, the extent, there's a lot of panic about drugs. Yes, some people get into trouble with drugs. There's no doubt about that, just like they get into trouble with alcohol, just like they get into trouble with other forms of obsessive behavior like gambling. But that doesn't, the crisis comes from the fact that these drugs are available only on the black market. So if you become addicted to heroin, you're going to have to commit crimes in order to get the money to pay for the inflated black market price of the drug. One thing that people, one of the absurdities of the war on drugs, and we do have it, and I agree with you, that our war is not quite as abusive as the war in the States, but it's still very, there's still significant abuses associated with it. One of the ironies of this is it's utter folly. In effect, people say that, look, we've got a real drug crisis here. We've got drug use out of control, so therefore let's do more of what hasn't worked. Law enforcement hasn't stopped us from having this so-called drug crisis now, so let's do more of it. It's like somebody said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here we've got obviously there are drug use problems in this country. Anybody who's been to the downtown east side of Vancouver can see that. And into many other communities, and I agree, port cities the problem can be very visible in port cities. But those are problems that have arisen under the current system of criminal prohibition. And people are saying, well, we've got a problem, so let's do more of what obviously isn't working. Why not instead of doing more of what isn't working, why don't we start looking at other measures that can work? I give, for example, things like in Vancouver, they've got the safe injection site to help get people out of the alleyways and so they don't get infected with HIV infection and hepatitis C infection. They're going to start a heroin maintenance program. Right now in BC and in most provinces across the country, you can get methadone as a substitute drug for heroin addiction. But some people don't respond well to that, and so there's going to be a pilot project starting giving heroin to heroin addicts to try to maintain them on a clean, safe dose. And programs like this have been working in England for decades. They've been working for over a decade in Switzerland, or almost a decade in Switzerland. They're in place in the Netherlands. These are programs that actually are based on their health measures rather than criminal justice measures.
And so this is going to be starting in Vancouver, prescribing actual heroin to heroin addicts.
Yeah, to a small, it's going to be a pilot project. It'll be in Vancouver, then Toronto and Montreal. And this is going to start, they've been saying it was about to start for about a year now, so the exact starting date is still up in the air. But it looks like it's fairly close to starting.
Is this the Naomi project?
Yes.
Right, okay.
And North American Opiate Medication Initiative, and that's what NAOMI stands for, yeah.
Why is it that you think that that the war is being fought in this way, the war on drugs or whatever?
Well, I teach a course in drug policy at the University of Ottawa, and I spend a lot of time looking at this. It's like anything in the world. You've got to look at who benefits from the approach we've taken. Obviously, organized crime gets fantastically wealthy. I mean, we're pumping billions of dollars a year into the hands of criminal groups in Canada, okay? So they love prohibition. People in the United States, there's a large private sector prison industry where private sector companies actually run prisons. And about one quarter of all American prisoners are in privately run jails. So these companies want more bodies in jail. So the more people you've got thrown in jail for whatever, the more profit they make. So you really have to look at who profits from the present system. Politicians, you know, get reelected by promising to be tough on drugs, so they profit from prohibition too. You know, because they sort of work with a gullible public that believes that, you know, let's do more policing, that will solve the problem. And so politicians use that as a way to get reelected. Police departments, you know, although many police realize the futility of law enforcement as a means for dealing with drugs, their police chiefs, their police departments know full well that they get big budgets by saying that, look, we got a drug problem, we need more money to solve that. So, and government departments, Health Canada, the RCMP, the various, you know, Canada Border Services Agency, the various government agencies that deal with drugs in our society, these are people whose jobs are created because of the war on drugs. And as much as we'd like to think that our government bureaucracies are serving the public interest, most government bureaucracies at the end of the day are serving their own interests. You know, I hate to be that cynical about it, but you see the same thing with the United Nations organizations dealing with drugs. You've got people who are employed in Vienna, they got a nice job, their kids go to private schools in Vienna, and they know that if they rock the boat, they're going to get shipped off to Lagos, Nigeria, or something like that. So they're not going to challenge policies that they know aren't working, simply because it serves their personal interests. So you can understand why we have the system we've got by looking at who profits from it. And then the other factor is propaganda. There has been an enormous amount of propaganda, again, usually given out by the people who profit from the system, about the need to continue fighting drugs through the criminal justice system. So a lot of people actually believe that the best way to deal with drugs is through the criminal justice system. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the work I do is aimed at having to challenge that propaganda and challenge that misunderstanding. After years of studying this issue and working with colleagues around the world on this, I'm absolutely convinced that criminal prohibition just makes the problem far worse than it would otherwise be.
Do you think, going back to this Texas Ranger story, do you think that this whole thing of bringing these Rangers in here and stuff, that's part of a broader policy of bringing Canada and the U.S. closer together in many different ways?
Well, I don't know if it's a deliberate policy, but there's certainly it may be part of a grander scheme to go ahead and you know, make the two nations more as one. Which, you know, as a Canadian, I do not want to adopt the values of the U.S. government in Canada, and so I fear that just as a Canadian national. But from the perspective of drug law enforcement, I'm sure what they're trying to do is find a way that they can stem the flow of drugs into the United States. And one thing that I think, again, it's important for your listeners to be aware of is you'll hear claims time and time again from government officials, particularly American government officials, that Canada is a major exporter of marijuana to the United States. That is simply untrue. That is utter, utter nonsense. And I've looked at this issue extensively. I've looked at reports by the United Nations, by the U.S. government, by the Canadian government, by the Auditor General of Canada, by joint U.S.-Canada task forces that have looked at the issue. They have all unanimously concluded that Canada only supplies a very, very small amount of the U.S. market for cannabis. Okay? Mm. Something like about 2% of the cannabis market.
And so are they growing it themselves, or is it coming from elsewhere?
The United States, most of the marijuana that it imports into the United States, it gets through Mexico, okay?
Hmm.
But it probably produces, you know, perhaps a third to a half or even more of its own marijuana domestically. You know, despite, and here again, it just points to the futility of this law enforcement approach that, you know, despite having these tough laws, based on a lot of the estimates, it looks like the United States produces more marijuana per capita than Canada does. So in other words, it per person, it produces more marijuana itself than we do, despite having much tougher laws in the United States.
So why is it that they want to put the propaganda out there saying that Canada is this big, scary producer and all of its...
Well, it's because they want to have the capacity to, first of all, to scare Canadians away from changing their drug laws, and because it serves their interests. I mean, any time you read a story about drugs, you've really got to ask, you know, whose interest does it serve to go ahead and portray the information in this way?
Hmm. Do you think there's any connection as well between the demonization of marijuana and its applications in its cousin plant, hemp, the various things that we could use hemp for that would...
Well, historically, I mean, that was certainly one of the that was one of the hidden justifications for banning hemp in the United States in the 1930s, or for banning marijuana in the United States in the 1930s, is because it would essentially eliminate the production of hemp too, which was a competitor to pulp and paper products, and which was also a competitor to some of the newer petrochemical products like nylon, you know, ropes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, banning hemp got a competing product out of the way.
But you don't think that maybe those same producers today are they must be at least quite happy that hemp isn't being used for the same products.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I mean, let's face it. People want to make money, and they don't want something to threaten their ability to make money. And if somebody's producing a product that will become less competitive when a competitor is introduced to it, those people are not going to want hemp to be introduced. Plain and simple, it's simple economics. You know, people don't want. It doesn't matter if hemp is good for, you know, the economy or good for agriculture or less polluting or, you know, more environmentally sustainable. It doesn't matter to these companies. All they're worried about is the bottom line. That's unfortunately how our economic system works. Basically,
it seems like in essence, the whole drug war, like a lot of things, is basically people who benefit from a problem staying an unsolved problem.
Yeah. Well, and you can look at this in the United States, again, where they've, obviously there's a problem with serious ghettos in the United States. Well, you know, instead of looking at some of the real problems in the ghettos, like, unemployment, poverty, racism, deteriorating social conditions, lack of municipal infrastructure in places like that, you can just go ahead and blame everything that goes wrong in the ghetto, blame it all on drugs. And you'll always have drugs there, as we will never get rid of drugs in our society, so you'll always have a boogeyman to blame for all these problems, and then you don't need to address the real source of the problems. You know, it's just like, you can blame drugs for a lot of the problems in, say, the downtown east side of Vancouver or for youth crime or things like that. But, you know, let's start to ask why people are using drugs. One of the big problems right now with the current approach we've got is that we rarely ask, why are people using drugs? You know, why do I not use heroin, cocaine? Why do I not inject cocaine? Probably because I'm quite happy with my life. I haven't experienced any serious trauma that I need to try and hide through using drugs. But other people sometimes are using drugs to deal with some very serious trauma in their lives, and punishing them on top of the trauma they've already experienced does not help them. You know, let's start looking at maybe preventing the trauma, preventing child abuse, reducing, sexual abuse of kids and physical violence, and trying to deal with some of the alienation of Aboriginal societies in Canada. If we can address some of those issues, which requires more thought and more intelligent action than just saying no and pointing a gun at somebody, if we can do with those things, we're going to get rid of some of the reasons why people use drugs in a dangerous way.
I think certainly we need to take personal responsibility in a lot of things, and that's something that we've given up more and more over the years.
Yeah, well, I mean, people need to understand that their actions have consequences. On the other hand, there's an issue of freedom here, too, and rationality. Why is it that alcohol is a legal product that can be advertised? And there are controls on it. Obviously, underage drinking is prohibited, things like that, and drunk driving is prohibited. But why can you have this drug, which potentially can be very, very dangerous, and you look at fetal alcohol syndrome from mothers who've been drinking and things like that, it can have very severe consequences. Why is that drug legal, and yet other drugs that are, in effect, far less harmful to the vast majority of people who use them, like cannabis, why is that illegal?
Seems very arbitrary.
Yeah, and why does the government interfere with some activities and not others? Like, for example, we know that obesity is a major cause of heart disease, which is a major cause of death in this country. Why do we not throw people in jail for overeating? You know, we say that we don't want people to use drugs because it's bad for them and bad for society around them. And yet, I'll tell you, if somebody gets, you know, if the breadwinner of a family is obese, gets a heart attack, and dies, that's far worse, or just as bad, if not worse, for the family than if somebody were using drugs and died of an overdose. I mean, so we're inconsistent in our approach. What we've done with issues like obesity is we're trying to get health messages out there. And with smoking, let's take smoking, for example. 50 years ago in this country, half the adult population smoked. Okay, 50 years ago. During the past 50 years, tobacco has remained a legal product, okay? We've changed the way we regulate it. You know, we've banned advertising, we've restricted on sales to minors and stuff like that. And what has happened? The rate of smoking has dropped from about half the population to around 20% of the population. So you can have a legal drug and you can regulate it. You can make a drug legal, have it legal, and regulate it intelligently in a way that actually reduces use of the drug. So regulating cannabis and regulating heroin and cocaine doesn't need to result in an increase in use.
There's a funny idea out there that if we started to prescribe heroin to people or made it legal, that everybody would start all of a sudden using it.
No, and you know, if heroin were legal tomorrow, would you or would Julie or would I use it?
No, of course not.
And you know what we've done is we have changed the rules. And you know, here's another thing: you've got to look at and see, why do young girls smoke? Young girls smoke because it helps them stay thin, because nicotine is an appetite suppressant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so why do young girls want to stay thin? Well, obviously, it's because they've got an image issue. They want, you know, there's something out there that's saying you've got to stay thin because that's the way to be, you know, in or popular in society or whatever. Well, telling them not to smoke isn't going to work as long as there's that pressure to stay thin. So you've got to dig one level deeper than the actual smoking. It's not just a matter of saying don't smoke, because kids aren't going to listen to that message unless you can address their underlying reason for smoking. And it's the same thing I said with the illegal drugs. You've got to get at why people are using drugs in a dangerous way. Most people who use heroin, most people who use cocaine, do so occasionally, are not dependent on it. Okay, and this is, again, part of the mythology. You do not become instantly addicted to crack. You do not become instantly addicted to crystal meth. There is the potential for addiction. But most people who use these things don't become addicted. You know, what we want to do is have intelligent health-based messages saying, look, you can use this stuff, but if you do, there's the potential that you could be harmed by it. Have some respect for your own body.
Mm-hmm.
If you try crystal methamphetamine, it may have some serious consequences for you down the road. Do you really want to do that?
And I agree that we should be looking at the roots of these problems, because they go way deeper than we're acknowledging.
Exactly. And a lot of heavy drug use, too. I mean, there are people using drugs as a way of, they're mentally ill. And how does it help us to criminalize those people, to turn them into criminals? They may be bipolar or things like that. They may use drugs to medicate their in response to their mental condition. Why do we punish these people? Let's treat this as a health issue and instead of punishing people and wasting. Think of what we could do with that money, if we didn't throw these people in jail, who don't need to be thrown in jail, because generally they're not a physical threat to other people, what could we do by spending that money on social programs and trying to treat mental illness?
Rehabilitation.
Yeah.
And when they go to jail, too, there's a plethora of drugs available
absolutely.
In prisons, and so their problems are going to be exacerbated.
And they think that we can stop drugs from coming into Canada when we can't even stop them from coming into prisons where people are locked up 24 hours a day. There's not a prison in Canada where drugs are not readily available.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if people think that somehow we can police our way out of this, they can't. We can't even do it with people locked up in a building. So how are we going to do it for a country of 3 million square miles? And so it's up to us as the public to go ahead and make it clear to politicians that we're not going to tolerate continued reliance on this tired old rhetoric about the war on drugs and these tired old measures which don't work and which violate the liberties of all of us.
Hear, hear. Well, Mr. Oscapella, it has been very interesting talking to you and very illuminating indeed.
Okay, well, thank you, Jamie and Julie. I enjoyed it very much, and I hope you have lots of sunshine in Nanaimo.